This is an ABC podcast.
Well, we love a gimmick here at the Minefield, don't we? We love a way of organising programs under themes so that we can have conversations we want to have that otherwise we couldn't justify by being pegged to events. Let me just be really clear about that. That's what we're doing today, and I'm pretty excited about it, actually. I think sometimes our most enjoyable moments stem from that shameless process. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my conspiring co-host or co-conspirator.
Co-conspirator. That was a much more concise way of putting it.
Yeah. This is going to be fun, I reckon.
Yep.
You remember last year we did the, what do we call it?
False necessities. That's right.
We kind of declared that up front at the start of the year. Mm-hmm. This we haven't declared. So we should perhaps try to explain what we're doing before we get stuck in, shouldn't we?
We should. And we should also say, and this is actually very much in line with the theme of the show, we're making a certain pledge in saying this. This is the reason, by the way, that, you know, if you go through a wedding ceremony, unless you are one of those lucky people that does it at the registry office and therefore, you know, avoids all the horribleness that is associated with weddings, you make certain vows in front of witnesses. And so one of the things that we do when we make certain promises from the outset in front of all these witnesses is that it puts us under a degree of moral obligation where we have to now do what it is that we say, even though at this point of the year, we have absolutely no idea what we're doing in making this particular pledge. Is that all right? Is that?
I think it's great.
Okay, good.
It's the way life should be.
It is. It is. So I should also say, we haven't talked about this. We've sent messages back and forth about it that didn't, in fact, arrive at a particular conclusion.
You're making this sound very well organized.
Yeah, it's really not, but it also kind of is. So in the Christian tradition, there's this technique for elaborating the various ways in which human beings and human character can go terribly wrong, the ways in which humans can sink down, if you like, into the depths of moral depravity. These are fashionably or commonly known as seven deadly sins. They were previously, I think, probably better referred to as the seven principal or cardinal vices. It begins in the 6th century with Pope Gregory the Great. It was probably best elaborated, though, by St. Thomas Aquinas. These are the seven vices that reflect a peculiarly debased soul, although in their very debasedness, there's something kind of awfully common and shared about them. It's a way of saying these are the things that we all indulge in various degrees. When you do indulge in them, recognize them for what they are, the dangers that are inherent in them to yourself and to others, and steer clear. So the list is pretty well known to most of us. There's pride or vanity, greed, lust, envy, gluttony, anger, sloth. The point, of course, of elaborating these seven vices wasn't just to obsess about the vices, but to commend the series of corresponding virtues like humility, charity, chastity, gratitude, temperance, forbearance, and diligence. Now, I think these lists, the seven deadly sins, the seven cardinal virtues, they have something going for them. I think they really are good as forms of moral provocation. There are problems with them as well. I mean, one of the people I think that best pointed out some of the dangers was the 16th century philosopher Michel de Montaigne, who said that not only is the list incomplete, but the list places the emphasis in the wrong place by putting pride or vanity as the chiefest, as the first, the worst, the most basic of all of the vices. It gets things, it sets off, if you like, on the wrong foot. But Montaigne also pointed out, and this is really interesting to me, that if you want to think about it this way, all of these vices are vertical. They are about me and a degree of giving in to certain temptation that then debases my soul as I do it. Whereas, and all of them have a relational aspect to them, but where Montaigne really put the stress was on what he would refer to as ordinary vices, the vices that we get up to every day that have corrosive effects on the relationships all around us. And he named these as vices like lying. Notice that lying doesn't appear in the list of seven deadly sins. Lying, treachery, disloyalty, cruelty. For Montaigne, these are the basic ones. And what makes them so basic and so terrible is that we get up to them all the time. So what we're going to do this year, here we go. We're not going to do the seven deadly sins because I don't agree with all of them. And, you know, I think they're ones that should be there and ones that shouldn't be there. Maybe. Well, they all should probably be there, but I don't think we should think about them as much as we do. There are other vices that really should be there that I think we truly are guilty of at an extraordinary level in just the way that we carry on modern life. So over the next, what, 8, 9, 10 months? Who knows?
As long as they'll have us.
As long as they'll have us. We're going to devote one show a month to one of these ordinary vices, to one of these deadly sins, as a way of both trying to recover what makes them perfidious, and also it tries to diagnose, I think, wherein lies their danger, the harm that it does to us and to others, but also hopefully, to commend a better way, to try to, okay, if this is bad, if this is harmful to me and to others, then what's the remedy? What is that vice the repudiation of? Is that okay as a summary of what it is we're going to do?
Yeah, I think so. I like that a couple of years ago, was it? We did a thing on virtues.
We did.
So we finally got to the countervailing series.
We did unfashionable virtues, didn't we? Unfashionable virtues.
Yeah, but that was consecutive because that was during Ramadan.
That's right, wasn't it?
Although the way you've sort of explained the seven deadly sins as having countervailing vices, it strikes me that what we probably should have done is gone back to that series and then figured out what the countervailing vice was for each of the things and come up with our own. It's probably what we should have done.
Well, but we did kind of do it in the course of the conversation. With each one that we did kind of hold up, so this is what it's supposed to, yeah. These are the ways in which virtues can, in fact, flip over to vice. We did that.
We should probably explain then which vices we're talking about here, because you've given a list and then you've said that's complicated and so on. So where are we settling, or are we just going to figure this out as we go through the year?
Well, I don't think we give a list, because I'm really interested in seeing how things go, because there's certain things that our producer, for instance, has suggested that really should be on the list. And until she suggested, I thought, wow. Anyway, where I think we start today, I don't know if it's the most basic, if it's the first one, if it's the worst of the lot. If it isn't, it's damn near close. Mm-hmm. It's lying.
Oh, you've gone Montaigne on us.
I have. Well spotted. Mm. Because for Montaigne, what lying is the corruption of the fundamental bond, the compact, the contract, the form of commonality that exists between people. When you lie, you are taking that which is in common, namely words, our shared commerce of speech, and you are bending it towards yourself. And in the process of bending it towards yourself and your own ends, you are thereby breaking the capacity of other people within that community to find you trustworthy. In other words, the very act of lying, it's not just being individually deceptive, but it's actively corroding the very thing that holds us most and best in common. That's Montaigne's critique. I think he's actually very Augustinian on that point, by the way, which we can get to a bit later. But I find that a wonderful way of thinking about lying. It's not just a private vice or a white lie. There's something about lying that corrodes the bonds of commonality between us. And that's what I think makes it particularly vicious.
Okay. So there are two things I want to say here. One is, I don't share quite how enamored you are of Montaigne's criticism of the seven deadly sins.
Because I think you would be. I like this.
Well, just because I think the seven deadly sins, as sort of listed through the Christian tradition, are really ones that go to character. And so I find the more relational sins, as Montaigne articulates, tend to be, in my view, derivative. So lying is very often, I think, a product of pride or vanity.
Yep.
For example, that's why we do it. It may be a product of greed. I suppose it could be a product of lust or envy. Gluttony is harder for me to identify how that arrives or derives from it. But you get the point I'm making. So I see the original, if you like, the original gangster, Seven Deadly Sins, as being more generative, I suppose.
Are they the primary colours, are they?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Okay.
And I'm not necessarily here to argue for that particular list of seven, but I can see where they're heading, right? And for me, the concept of character becomes fundamental. But the other thing I want to say about lying is it's a very complicated conversation to have, because you run into definitional things all the time.
Yeah.
So this question of lying, or this diagnosis of lying as something that corrodes fundamental relational bonds, I think only works insofar as you exclude forms of lying that are designed to preserve those bonds, right? Mm-hmm. So, which we might refer to as white lies or whatever it is. But sometimes what lying is doing is seeking to preserve a social connection that could be compromised by a kind of unvarnished truth, right? Mm-hmm. And that there are sometimes lies we tell each other and perhaps even ourselves for the sustainability of our social systems. How do you accommodate them within Montaigne's critique, which you're adopting?
Yes, well, that's a wonderful point, but thankfully it's something that, for instance, Immanuel Kant traversed very, very, very nicely in his, to some degree, accommodation of, but also fairly resounding critique of what are referred to as paternalistic lies. So these would be lies that are done in the good of another person. And that's kind of what you're referring to. The lies, you know, you could even just think of the end of The Dark Knight, couldn't you? The lie that Batman has to tell that Harvey, Harvey Dent. Thank you. I've never blanked on a supervillain's
name. I've never seen this happen. It's remarkable.
The fact that Harvey Dent is in fact a white knight and that his pristine reputation is what then holds the cohesion of Gotham City in its hands.
Which, if you like, you could extrapolate to the kind of lying, or shall we call cosmetic buffering, that we do to institutions. Because in the absence of faith being had in those institutions, we tend to descend into a kind of wasteland. And we're possibly going through that kind of process right now.
Mm-hmm. Look, by the way, Plato also had a big thing about noble, the virtue of the noble lie, or in fact, the problem of the noble lie. Here's where, what worries me about the conversation taking this particular detour. And here's where I probably don't want to go quite so far as Augustine's absolute prohibition, his kind of absolutism concerning lying, that lying in all occasions and under all circumstances is illicit. What I think the problem is, as soon as we begin squabbling about what makes a lie, what doesn't make a lie, how you define a lie, how you don't define a lie, to what extent is this a benign lie, and to what extent is this a vicious lie? I guess the problem is, what it begins to overshadow or obscure somewhat is, again, the fundamental nature of communication itself. Because what communication does, it's not just a single or punctiliar act. Communication is something that holds people together through moments of disagreement, through moments of experimentation, where you kind of try to see where one sits in the world and in a particular relationship, through moments of repudiation, where you yourself are found fault with and then to some degree reformed and brought into better or closer communication with others. Language is an incredibly fragile thing. But the very fact that language is, in fact, our moral medium, it is the climate in which we exist. It is a climate in which everything that matters most within the human life exists. What undergirds language is the fragility of trust itself. As soon as language becomes, if you like, turned into a tool whereby I simply get what I want, or a means by which I can preserve a degree of not so much peace, but at least non-conflict, or when language becomes the way in which I try to manufacture or manicure a certain image that I have of myself, all of those things take place to the detriment of somebody else. Maybe not the detriment at this particular moment, but the very renunciation, for instance, of moments of moral provocation, of confrontation, of argumentation, and then hopefully reconciliation. All of those moments are vital moments within the process of the increasingly becoming dignified of human dignity. So as soon as you sacrifice all of these moments, there is something not necessarily at a particular moment, but there is something in the process of moral formation and of being community that we fundamentally lose.
Yeah, I think that's a particular kind of lying. What about where, you know what, let's get to the guest. I think that'll be an easy way of doing it. I just think that there are kinds of lying that we're overlooking here that become then definitional questions of whether you're talking about lying. Consider the case where it's like someone does something that's mildly annoying and they say, is that okay? And you go, yeah, it's fine. It's not fine, but you're actually seeking to preserve a social bond because that's the higher order consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about a lie there?
No, see, I don't think so. Because what that question, is that okay, what that might be doing is it might be holding up for scrutiny the degree of unwarranted or unnecessary irritation that I'm feeling at a particular moment. And then by posing the question
It
may not be. That's exactly right. But by posing the question, that then snaps me into a moment of reflection where maybe that is annoying to me, but does it have to be? So I think there is something, there is a process of accommodation there that isn't necessarily deceitful. The bigger question for me, Waleed, is where do we hold the status of, to use Henry Frankfurt's term, of bullshit, where the person may well not be lying in the sense of actively deceiving, but, for instance, I've been asked to talk about something that I have absolutely no clear idea about. And so I waffle on with no particular clear relationship to the truth. I don't care whether what I'm saying is true or not. What I care about is being embarrassed or being shown up as not knowing something I should have been across. So there may not be the active intention to deceive there, but there is an elevation of the status of the self over a recognition of the impersonality and therefore the objectivity of the truth there that probably is really, really troublesome.
No need to undermine my entire media career in one stroke there, Scott. You're listening to The Mindfield. You can listen to the show on RN. You might be doing that right now. But we have a podcast. It includes additional discussion with our guest, which you can subscribe to wherever it is you do such things. But you can also listen to it anytime you like on the ABC Listen app. Scott, we need some help.
We do indeed. Paul Formosa is Associate Professor in the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University. He's a specialist on Immanuel Kant, who is central in every conceivable way to this conversation. And you could say central to moral philosophy generally. So it's kind of good that we've got him on the show. Paul, thanks so much for coming on The Mindfield.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Where do you want to take...
Is it though, or is that a lie?
Grinding his fingernails on the other side of the desk.
Social nicety. So we can come back
right.
to that.
Sorry,
let's start there. Yes, please.
Yes. This is my point, right? How austere do you want to be in the way that you conceive of what lying is?
Yeah, I mean, so there's kind of two questions, like, what is a lie? And then... why is lying wrong? And then when is lying permissible? So look at this case. So the standard way lying is defined is asserting something you believe to be false with the intention to deceive others about it. Now, there's lots of problems and issues with that one. So one, you've got to believe something to be false. You've got to communicate that to somebody else. And you've got to be doing that with the intention of getting them to actually think that's true. Now, there's lots of ways that that might kind of break down. So one obvious way is cases of omissions, where you just avoid the question. So if someone says, did you take my cake? And I say, oh, I don't really like cake. Now, that might be true, but I actually took the cake. And by not answering that, is that a lie or in a case of omission? Other sorts of cases may be, is the bullshit case or the bold-faced lie case, where it's such a bold-faced lie that it's not even meant to deceive. You know I'm lying, and that's kind of like the whole point. I must have almost no regard for you that I'm just going to blatantly lie like this. And so there's no intention to deceive. So when we think about these kind of white lie social niceties, like one question is it meant to be deceptive? Or do we both know that really I'm just going to say, you know, it's nice to be here even if it's terrible? Because that's just the kind of social nicety that we do. And there's no intention to deceive, and so it's not a lie. Or is it deceptive, but it's such a minor form of deception that I don't really care about it? So I'm not really sure which kind of thing it is.
Let's say it is deceptive, but it's deceptive to a purpose that is itself noble.
Yeah. Well, then I think we come to why is it wrong or not? And then I think we need to think about why is lying wrong? And I mean, there's a couple of different ways you can kind of answer. I mean, the standard kind of utilitarian account would just be to look at the bad consequences of lying. If I lie all the time, then people won't believe me, my reputation will go down, trust will disappear, and so on. But I'm much more interested in the sort of three Kantian arguments that we have here, because it comes back to this question that you're kind of looking at, kind of these pro-social lies, where you're lying for a good end, not to out of greed to get something for yourself, but to maybe make the other person happy or something like that, or just to avoid social tension. And here I think it comes back to some of Scott's points about the very point of communication and the role of lying. And that comes out, I think, in three kind of distinct arguments that Kant gives against lying, which if we've got time, I'll quickly go through. So the first one is a kind of practical contradiction. So this comes out of the first version of the categorical imperative, the idea that you should only act on maxims that you could will to be universal laws. So it sounds kind of complicated, but the idea is pretty simple. All you do is basically imagine what happens if everyone acted the same way you did. Is that a world you could will or conceive of? And in the lying case, it's not, right? So imagine that you lied to someone out of self-interest, right? You made a false promise. You said, I'll pay you back, but that's a lie. Now imagine that everybody does this as a kind of law of nature. What would happen? Well, the very practice of promise making would break down. communication in that sense would break down. You couldn't make a promise because everyone would know it would be a lie. And so you couldn't get what you wanted by lying, because in such a world, there would be no promise making, and thus lying wouldn't work. So I think that kind of tells you something about the role of language in communication, the way that if every word were to do it, lying destroys communication or destroys various sorts of social practices, and that it only works because you're free riding on other people not lying all the time. Mm. So I think that's kind of powerful. It leads to the sort of second one, which is a kind of teleological contradiction. And here Kant's really following quite a long tradition. I mean, Scott mentioned Augustine, Aquinas, this idea that there's a purpose to speech. And so Kant's idea is that the purpose of speech or communication is to convey your thoughts to others. And lying is directly proposed to that natural purposiveness of language and communication. And therefore, if you universalize, it would destroy the very purpose of communication. And so once again, you get this idea that lying sort of strikes at the very root of social intercourse and communication. And once again, it only works because people are kind of free riding. And so I think both of those point to this kind of way that lying is really corrosive of I guess, interaction or relations, but also communication in ways that's quite, I guess, quite central to what allows social relations and communication to occur.
So is that a test for determining what is lying then?
No, that's a test to determine whether lying's permissible or not. So it is a separate question then, whether something's a lie or a deception or just a social nicety that's not really a lie. So it doesn't really answer that other question. It kind of answers whether the lie is permissible. But one thing it does do is it gets us to move beyond just thinking about is lying permissible or not, and to think about lying in particular circumstances for particular ends. So an example I gave you, the lie was to, you know, get money by making a false promise. So that might be impermissible, but what about some of the examples you were talking about before, like lying to make someone feel good? And that's not, I mean, that's a separate question we could look at.
But sorry, Paul, but I mean, Kant's critique of lying, for instance, in order to get something, like making a false promise in order to acquire, I mean, he equates that with, for instance, the use of coercive force. What you are doing in doing that is overriding somebody's the activity of consent, of giving consent, and therefore both undermining and kind of going beyond or undercutting the very dignity of the other person as a rational character who can make decisions in and of themselves. So to equate, I think, lying and the use of force there, that for me, I mean, there's aspects of Kant's argument I'm not with, but that equation, I think, of lying and force as a way of overcoming the unforthcoming consent of another person, that I think is a really, really powerful argument.
Yeah, I agree. That doesn't actually come out until he introduces this idea of the form of humanity, which is the idea that we'd always treat others as end themselves and never as mere means. And when he talks about lying in that case, he says, well, what's wrong with lying in that case is you treat someone in a way that they couldn't possibly consent to. And so it's a little complicated what he might mean by that, but I think it kind of makes sense like this. So imagine that someone says to you, you know, can I borrow some money? And so what you're being asked to consent to is a borrowing relationship, and you can either say yes or no. But in this case, assume they're lying, and you give them the money, and of course, they never pay you back. So in a sense, you couldn't consent to that interaction because you were deceived about what the interaction was. And so that way, you're treating others not as ends of themselves, which means basically as autonomous agents who can direct themselves. Instead, you're treating them as like a tool that you manipulate to get what you want. And so then the contrast would be if I told you that, in fact, I just want you to lend me money. I'm not going to pay you back, but would you just lend me money? Then you're treating me as an end myself, because then I'm given the opportunity to decide whether I want to help you or not. I understand what's going on and I can consent to it or not. And so in that way, you're treating me as an end myself, as a sort of agent with dignity who you interact with in consensual ways, whereas the other way you treat me as kind of like a tool that you try and manipulate and use. And I think that points to the general way that lying, the way it kind of works, is that it is transforms communication from this form of expressing what you think to others, and it transforms it into a kind of strategic tool of manipulation to get what you want. And in that way, you sort of demean the dignity of others by transforming them into this thing that you use almost like a cash machine, in a sense, rather than an agent who could freely give you money.
There's a lot there, I think, for us to explore further. And it does kind of underscore a bit the point I was making before, Scott, about how I think this vice of lying is itself derivative. I think part of what we're getting at here are the underlying sort of character flaws that are there. You want to point to the socially consequential elements of it?
You've branded me a consequentialist again.
Oh, I've done that a long time. Yeah,
I know, but it's just not true. And I'll show
you why.
Sorry,
Scott, we're out of time. No time for your defense. That's the end of the radio portion of the show. We got the podcast bit, so Scott might mount a defense in that. Paul, please do hang around. We've got a lot more of your wisdom to explore. That's
great,
Paul
so
Formosa, who's Associate Professor in the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University, our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield. We're done with the radio part of the show. Here's the podcast now, and we'll see you next week.
Waleed, do you want to pick up on why you think this is derivative then? Why you think a line is derivative?
I mean, what do you mean by derivative here? Derivative of what? A more fundamental character flaw?
Pride is the primary color here.
Or greed.
Or greed or vanity, yes.
I mean, you could take your... I mean, it could be sloth, right? It depends on the lie and it depends on the circumstance. But I do feel that if those sort of underlying character flaws... Imagine a world where they could be cured, then the lying sort of disappears as a consequence of that, right?
I mean, one view is they're not kind of derivative. There's not, they're all kind of a... I mean, it might be sort of the flip side of the unity of the virtues idea, that if you have one virtue, you kind of have them all. And it might be that vices are the sort of same. If you have one, you have them all. So if you get rid of one, it sort of kind of gets rid of the other and vice versa. I mean, this idea is actually kind of interesting in Kant's philosophy because he's got this idea of our radical evil, which for him is kind of foundational. Mm. And for Kant, that means... at the very root of your character, which is why he calls it radical, there's either this kind of unconditional commitment to morality or there's not. You're willing to put a price on your commitment to morality. In a sense, for Kant, that is the kind of foundational, I guess, character flaw that underwrites all the more particular vices like sloth, envy, and dishonesty. They're all kind of more particular, but they all sort of manifest from this underlying flaw in your character that you're not really committed to morality. For various sorts of reasons, you're going to shove it to one side when the costs get high enough. So, yeah. I mean, that's one way to think of it as derivative.
Can I put... I don't think it's quite the counter case. I mean, what I like about Kant's critique of lying at this particular point is the degree to which he holds, I think, in a very productive tension, the extent to which lying debases the liar. I mean, he says that the person who lies, he kind of objectifies guilt with a capital G. It throws the liar into a kind of miasma of guilt such that one sees oneself as an object of self-contempt. I mean, that for me is very, very, very interesting. This notion, which actually, in fact, goes to Augustine as well, that the first victim of the commission of sin is the sinner, him or herself. I think there's something kind of interesting there. But also that the act of lying, by treating the other person as a means to my end, reduces that person to a tool and therefore treats them not with the dignity that's accorded to them, but contempt. I mean, all those things I think are very, very productive here. But I think there is something from the Augustinian tradition that helps supplement this. And when we talk about sort of speaking, communicating, the making of contracts, the making of promises, in that kind of casual sense, I do think that there is a form of commonness or commonality that goes behind that, that's even more important. So, I mean, when we speak, we use common language. I mean, that's all that we have. We use common language. So any act of speaking, it's not just expressive. I'm not just trying to give voice to something that I have inside or something that I want. I am exchanging, there's an act of kind of sharing together in the commerce of words. I'm putting myself out in a form of almost experimentation. I'm opening myself up then to repudiation, to correction, to affection, to affirmation, and in many cases to reformation, to the opportunity to be better, in fact, than I am. So the words that we use then, even though they're kind of mine, they are common words. What lying does is it grabs words that are common words, in other words, words that are in and of themselves invitations for other people to know me, to say something about me, to see something that's wrong with me. Lying is the taking of words that are common words, and it's the making of those words idiosyncratic. It's turning those words into my particular objects for my particular ends. And so Augustine has this idea of what, you know, evil is the taking of the good, which is directed towards something that is noble for us all, and it's the curving it around oneself so that it serves my own ends. I think understanding the act of lying as communication bent towards oneself. And here's where, I mean, I think this is where Henry Frankfurt's definition of bullshit has been. It's not so much lying as much as just a casual or non-respectful relationship to the truth. I don't care what is true. I just don't want to be found out as someone who's ignorant. I think that's where this is a really productive terrain to begin with the commonality of communication. The end of communication is being as ushering other people into a common space and then seeing that as then something that is, if you like, expropriated to my own ends. That, I think, if I had to really be pressed, now, that may be due to vanity. I think it probably can be. It may be due to greed. It probably can be. But it's the act itself of expropriating language. I think therein lies the viciousness of lying.
I think some of those cases might not be cases of lying, though. So think of a case, I mean, some of you talking about this kind of openness, willingness to listen and so on. You can think of a case, I mean, insofar as lying involves something you believe to be false, but trying to deceive others about it. Another case is one where you believe something to be true, but it's clearly false, but you nonetheless believe it. So let's assume climate change is real. The earnest climate change denialist is actually not lying when they say climate change is crap, doesn't exist. They really believe that, so it's not a lie. And yet, nonetheless, there's something very dangerous or troubling about their very cavalier approach to the truth. So, I mean, some of those things you're talking about are not really so much about lying, about more about this cavalier approach to the truth, unwillingness to be open and listen to others.
Which can, in fact, give rise to self-deception. And I think that is that's the further end of lying.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so you might think there has to be some self-deception in some of these cases. But I think after a while, it's not even about self-deception anymore. They just don't really care. Or the truth, I mean, I think comes this other issue that's connected to lying, this idea about seeing communication as really kind of a tool of manipulation. And so when you don't really care whether it's true or false or not, rather, this is just kind of one of our beliefs. This is one of our claims. Then it comes about, then the kind of truth or falsity of it becomes less of an issue. It's rather, I've just got to defend it come what may. And once again, that might not be a matter of lying because you might kind of believe it, but you just, in a sense, you also don't really care about the truth. And that's also quite a worrying, I think, moral attitude to have.
Mm. So what I immediately think of when we have this part of the conversation is that language exists in different kinds of modes, doesn't it? So let's consider the example of what I might, I don't know, clumsily call mediated communication or mediated language. So think of, say, political language or advertising or something like that, where the available opportunities for communication are limited. That is, they're compressed in time, for example. So you are required to say something very brief and pithy. Or in the case of advertising, there's kind of an expectation, is there not, that you're going to make quite wild, unsubstantiated claims in support of your product. You know, this is the best car on the planet or whatever. Are we expecting that when you say that, you genuinely believe this is the best car on the planet? Or are we prepared to accept that this is an example of what lawyers would call a puff? It's puffery. It's trying to sell you an idea in order to sell you a product, but we don't hold it to the same sort of standards we do when we're having interpersonal communication and we're talking about something that's quite serious. And as more and more of our world becomes mediated, right, the way in which we interact with each other is through one form of media or another, whether it be social or traditional or whatever, our access to the world is mediated. I feel like this mode of communication and the ethical judgments we make about it become really, really important because it shows up in practical examples all the time. That, this is why political advertising is so difficult to police, right? You can say there should be truth in political advertising, but it's almost impossible to police because just about anything that you say can one way or another be deemed true enough to be permissible within the context of political contest as a form of freedom of expression, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think what that really brings out is what's the rules of the language game we're playing at the moment? Like, what's the kind of norms that are going on? So take an example where you're clearly saying false things, but it's not deceptive. So in a play, right, actors say all sorts of things. They don't believe those things to be true, but no one's deceived by it because we know what's going on. So then the question is, like, so when we start to move these other cases, like, what is going on? Is it kind of like a play where they're just sort of saying these things, or is it supposed to be some sort of earnest discussion? And the problem is when it comes to, you know, lying in politics and so forth, often it's kind of unclear what exactly is going on, or they change between meters and it's unclear what is the relevant norms going on here. What is this? Is this meant to be all bullshit? Is it meant to be just manipulative? Am I really at some point actually trying to convince you with a rational argument? And all these things are kind of going on, and it's unclear which rules or which language game we're playing at any one particular time.
Because when everybody's lying, or when everybody's, if you like, playing the particular game, then everybody is given those cues not to take things overly seriously.
Yeah.
I guess where I'd want to pick up Waleed, and I mean, I'm partly absolutely in agreement with you, partly this scares the hell out of me. I mean, we've been witnessing, for instance, over the last 17 years, the tabloidization of the news, where virtually all news comes to be package-like and circulated in ways that we previously simply would have associated with tabloids. I think this form of mediated speech that you're talking about, whether it be embellishment, whether it be hyperbolization, whether it be things that are maybe needlessly constrained in order to get a particular point across or advertise a particular story, or things that are sexed up a little bit in order to gain a certain amount of traffic. When these things circulate and we all kind of just know, yeah, it's not really entirely true, but we kind of factor that in advance when it's probably clickbait, but, you know, I'm going to have a look at it anyway. I think that is the perfect example of why this kind of casual approach to lying really, really is problematic. So you've got someone like Simone Weil, and here's where I think I would take Simone Weil on the issue of truth and lying over Kant. I mean, okay, she did say that anyone who lies in newspapers because they're a public medium should be locked up and thrown away for life. So that's, I'm not entirely sure I'd go that far. But for Simone Weil, there is a thing called capital T truth. And it's not so much that we know what it is, but the fact that there is something out there that is impersonal, that doesn't care about me, that I don't owe my assent to so much as I owe my fealty or my adoration towards. She said the effect of that is to render everything that we say essentially provisional. So that when we speak, yes, we are engaging in forms of trust and attentiveness, but what we speak, we hold out for somebody else to repudiate and to show me how I'm wrong as a fundamental practice of communication, of love, of forgiveness, and so forth. I think what we're talking about here is the relativization of anything like capital T truth and the admission that, yes, everybody is just going to be circulating these various forms of bullshit in various degrees, and we just kind of factor that in advance. And what that does then is it renders impossible the very acts of repudiation, of correction, and then reformation on which the practice of relentless truth-telling requires.
I mean, this is exactly what kind of Hannah Arendt talks about in her essay on truth and politics.
Yes, that's right.
Where there's this idea that there's kind of truths, there's kind of factual truths about, Nazi Germany invaded Poland. There's analytic truths. And then there's just opinions. And what tends to happen is that we tend to reduce facts and truth to a matter of opinion. And of course, anybody can have an opinion, and any opinion is as good as any other. And when we reduce opinion, a truth to opinion, in a sense, we've relativized truth, that there's something out there. We've relativized it away until everyone's just got their own opinion. And that, I think, is really quite dangerous because it takes away the, I guess, factual foundation on which we stand, on which we need to debate, and sort of removes that, and instead just makes everyone's voice kind of count equally when it comes to determining what's true. And that, I think, is quite dangerous.
And in fact, I would even go further than that and say that opinion which exists without the possibility of repudiation is itself a lie. It has the formal structure of a lie because it is a form of speech that I use as an expression of myself, my own particular belief of the world, that then cannot be countered by someone else's speech, that makes no room in turn for then. So opinion without repudiation would then have the formal structure of a lie. If we sort of followed that path, I think we would, there's something kind of productive there.
Well, it wouldn't quite be a lie, right? If you believe it to be true, it can't be a lie, right? So instead, it's a kind of form of arrogance rather than a lie. But,
yeah,
sorry,
Waleed. I think that's right.
Well, I want to know how austere we want to be about this. So let's consider the circumstance of a head of government who has a minister who they've just sacked. I don't actually mean to comment on the particular case we've just witnessed not so long ago in Australia, but I just mean as a hypothetical situation, right? Very often in words that you say at that sort of moment or in the aftermath of a moment, you say a whole lot of things which you cannot possibly believe to be true, like, oh, they've done an excellent job, or they're a wonderful and valued colleague, or whatever. You see this after leadership spills all the time. Again, not to pick something that has actually been recently in the news. But, you know, we are now united. Well, you're not. Are we prepared to say that that's what we expect of our politicians, that they would come out and say, look, we're hopelessly divided. That's the truth of it. And if I could kick this person out of the party, I would, but I don't really have a choice about that. So I'm going to proceed as the leader of my party because I've won this process of, well, this round of bloodletting. I mean, do we want that kind of thing? Or is there a purpose to the kind of, I don't know, conventional lying that's going on in that sort of situation?
I mean, so one view is it's not lying, right? Because there's no intention to deceive. Let's assume we all know that you just have to go through this form of words. And so we're not really supposed to be deceived by it. No one actually is deceived by it. Then it might not count as lying.
Well, except they would quite like it if we were, wouldn't they? I mean, if we genuinely believe, they would be quite happy with that outcome.
That's right. Maybe they're intending to deceive, but they're failing at that intention. I mean, the other point you make, though, is honesty. And I guess not lying and honesty. There's kind of a gap in between. And so it's a separate question, like how honest we want people to be. And maybe, you know, this might be an idea, time to bring someone like virtue theory, and the idea that the virtue of honesty would be having the right amount of honesty, the right time, and sort of too much honesty or too much honesty at the right time might be kind of morally problematic as well. So, you know, maybe just because you're not lying doesn't mean you have to be overly honest either. I mean, there might be a time to sort of hold some things back, for example, without necessarily lying.
Yeah, but see, I actually think Kant's better here than virtue ethics. In your particular example, Waleed, to say we are a united team, that's a lie. That should be called out. That should not be said. But to preserve the dignity of the person who has just been professionally humiliated, say, I think there is something there. I mean, Kant had a lovely little formula about when and when not to feel and to express contempt in the Metaphysics of Morals. He said, you know, feeling contempt towards a particular person is licit. I mean, if they've done something contemptible, then you are entirely entitled to feel that. As soon as you communicate that in such a way that the person is publicly degraded, in such a way that the person who then speaks has no audience to be able to hear their own expressions of themselves, as soon as you communicate that act of degrading or derisory contempt, that then becomes illicit.
But imagine that in practice, right? Yeah. What would you make of ex-minister that you just sacked's contribution? I don't want to talk about that now. I mean,
you can find forms of words that will in fact be true and that should in fact be truthful, but don't leave the person open to this kind of unmitigated and unrestrained derision that then would take place in the public square, which then means then the person who does that to somebody on their own side of politics should in the same way refuse to reduce their opponents to objects of derision and contempt. This is where I think consistency in political speech would be very, very important.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're effectively saying is these forms of virtuous communication that we're talking about are only possible in a system or within a political culture that's built around it. Because what you're describing, it seems to me, is just about impossible in the current environment that we have, or the current political environment, I mean.
Which is in the thrall of deceptive speech, yes.
And possibly has fallen to one of the original seven deadly sins.
Oh, very nice. All right.
All right, Paul. Well, I think we're out of time now, but I think you'll understand what I'm saying when I say that I think Scott has done a wonderful job.
Is it deceptive or a lie, though?
Nope, we're out of time. Sorry. I cannot elaborate, and I can't find time to find the form of words that would pass every test. However, it is very clear that you've done a fantastic and formidable job for us, Paul. So thank you very much for helping us out.
Thank you very much. And great.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.